Just quickly to check, let me welcome all of you members here in the at M46 and also on the virtual. Mr. Zungula, can you hear us? Mr. Vuyo Zungula, can you hear us?
What's Lalon to call?
Thank you very much. Welcome to our session. Let me also welcome Public Projector and your team, Advocate Mpofu, the evidence leaders, Advocate Bauer and Advocate Mayosi. Welcome, Mr. Samuel. Welcome back, members of the public interacting with us in all of the platforms and the media, as well as welcome back our special guest on their last day with us. Thank you very much for that. We're going to resume our hearing. I had indicated yesterday that I would have set aside this morning so that members can interact with the witness. So I want to start there. And for that, I would like to invite members who will be indicating their readiness to interact with the witness. Sorry, I'm going to go ahead.
Could you say that again? Members who are ready to?
To interact with the witness. You don't seem to be ready. Or ask questions, or whatever you call it, Honorable Heron. Are you happy? Okay. Church, can you open this thing so that I can see those in the virtual? In the virtual, we're looking for your hands. Honorable Mylam. Honorable Helen, Honorable Mananiso, Sukas, Rodriguez, Andre, Hermans, Dape, Zungula, Peters, Honorable Maotwe, Hosanna, and Maneli. Those are the hands I have. I'm not expecting any provocation. I'll stay with those hands. Thank you very much. I think just before I give to the first, that That style you started last week seems to be more effective and working, where you don't just park a lot of questions, but you throw in it and get a return of service from the witness. I would appreciate that, so that we don't park questions. You just when I give you time, it is your space. Honorable Mylan.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Mr. Samuels. Good morning to the panel and good morning to everybody else present. Mr. Samuels, can you just give us a brief description of the organizational structure at the Office of the Public Protector? Very brief.
Thank you, Honorable Member. As you know, the office is headed by the Public Protector as the executive authority, and then followed by the Deputy Public Protector, and then there's the CEO in that order. And then reporting to the CEO, it would be the COO, Chief Operations Officer. The executive one.
Just pause, Mr. Samueli. You are recognized, Honorable Zungula?
Chair, just one thing. I'm under the impression that in accordance to the directives, we need to wait for the cross-examination to end before MPs can come in. So I just need to have clarity that and confirmation from Advocate Mbofu that they are done with the cross-examination.
Thank you for that. I don't know whether you were with us all the time yesterday. I had indicated yesterday that this morning we'll start with the members, and I would have given Advocate Mbofu the time that I allocated. He certainly, I'm sure, is going to raise if he would need any further time. So I did that first thing yesterday morning. So I hope that clarifies you.
Okay, can thank you. Can you also confirm, Chair, that he is done with cross-examination?
No. Honorable Zungula, that's not how we do it. That's not how we do. You're not going to be a spokesperson for Advocate Mbofu.
Chair, can I address you? Here I'm raising an issue as a member of the committee. That's the first thing. Secondly, you should not state or say that I'm a spokesperson to another person, whereas I'm raising whether are we following the procedure and are we being fair. So, Chair, I think this also speaks to you as to how biased you may seem, because it can't be that here Advocate Mbofu or the team representing the Public Protector, in my view, has not confirmed if they are done. Then you are saying someone is a spokesperson. Because if I was equally raising an issue on behalf of the evidence leaders, I don't think you would have said, I'm a spokesperson for the evidence leaders. So you need to be fair, Chair, in your approach. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Zungula. Advocate Mbofu, the Public Protector, are here to speak for themselves. And that's a point I'm making, and he has always done that. I don't expect a member to pretend to represent them. I did not recognize you, Honorable Zungula. I'm calling you out of order. I did not recognize you.
Chairperson, can the ITC mute Chair Honorable Zungula?
Chair, please no.
I will deal with that. Honorable Zungula, I want you to switch off your mic.
Please note me.
I've already noted you.
I need to correct what you are saying. Please note
me. Here is the point.
You allowed Honorable Nola to address you. Equally, allow me to address you.
Honorable Zungula, I'm not going to continue doing this with you.
Chair, on a point of order, Chair.
The point that I was making is that this inquiry, whether it's the evidence leader, is the representative of the public protector, is members, this happens everywhere else. We do things according to time set. You tailor make your input as evidence leader in terms of the time that you are required to do things. The same thing would happen with the legal representative of the public protector. So the issue is never the other extreme, where you'll only stop when you feel you're done. You've got to do everything else, prioritize your issues within a time set. I do that to you as members. I do that to the evidence leader. I do that to Advocate Mpofu. So we have to combine both the issue of fairness and with the reasonability of time that we're managing this process. Both go together. And I hope that your query was you had raised a clarification point. I've responded to it. Advocate Mpofu is raising his hand. I'm going to recognize him. And therefore, I don't need any to and fro in relation to this issue.
Chair, can you please recognize me after Advocate Mpofu? I've been raising my hand.
Advocate Mpofu?
Chair, no. Chair, I'm asking you if you are recognizing me. I've been raising my hand. Can you please recognize me?
Thank you, Honorable Maute.
Okay.
Advocate Mpofu?
Yes. No, thanks. Thank you, Chairperson. Yeah, I'm completely at sea as to what is happening now. I indicated to you many times yesterday that I'm far from finishing my cross-examination. At some stage, when I said to the witness that I'll raise this with you tomorrow, you even said, well, I'm not sure, but tomorrow we'll see how it goes or whatever the record will show. And then we come here to continue the cross-examination with no reference to us. The process just moves on. This is completely unfair. We can't run this like a kangaroo court.
This is not a kangaroo court. Yeah.
No, I'm saying we can't.
This is not a kangaroo court.
Yes, I hope so. So I'm saying that it can't happen like that. I mean, at the very least, if someone should have given me the courtesy of indicating A, that I'm being gagged, or that the cross-examination is finished by someone other than the one who's cross-examining. Yeah, it can't work like that. I just want to register. I did this before, I think after the fact. In fact, I was saying to the public protector now that, because I didn't want to interrupt Mr. Milam, that I'll find an opportunity to register this. As you say, and as Honorable Zungula says, yeah, we're not members, yeah, so we have no powers. But we can't be treated like this. It's just completely, I've never heard of a forum which just continues while you are almost mid-sentence. And okay. Just does the next thing. I mean, what is actually happening?
Thank you, Advocate Mpofu. I will address you.
Sorry, Chair. Let me just finish. I just wanted to say, I even thought maybe you were doing what you did with, was it Mr. Van Lochenberg or the other witness, Mr. Ibrahim, where you interposed the questions and then we said we would call him later, which I objected about last time. But now it turns out you're not even doing that. You're just moving on with the process without us covering some of the most critical issues that this witness has said. What will be the way?
Thank you, Advocate Mpofu. I'm going to respond to the question later. Please finish.
Yeah. I'm saying that what would be the worth of this evidence of this witness to anybody if it has not been tested by cross-examination? Some of the statements that he has made about information being fed to him which did not come from him, still have to be explored. So what I'm saying, Chair, is that, you know, we can move fast, but we move fast to a cliff, as it were, because it's not going to serve any purpose, I can tell you, whatsoever, to move on to the next stage when the directives are very clear. They were adopted here against our will, but they were adopted that members will only ask questions after the cross-examination. This is not after the cross-examination.
Thank you.
The cross-examination is in session. You stopped it yourself last night or yesterday afternoon at a point that suited you, not the public protector.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Advocate Mbof. I will respond to that and address you and make a ruling, but let me note Honorable Maotwe, Honorable Nodada, and Honorable Melda.
No, thank you, Chair. It's the same issue that I wanted to raise of saying you must be fair to this process, fair to the committee, fair to the people of South Africa, because our names are in this thing. So with the way you're conducting the meeting, we are all now bound by your actions that you are conducting yourself with. So the rules are clear, directives are clear. The cross-examination must finish, and then the members can engage. So if Advocate Mpofu says he's not finished, Che. Why are we in a hurry? Why are we rushing to just continue even if the cross-examination is not finished? We run the risk of going back. I mean, this is now the third witness where Advocate Mpofu has said, we'll look at whether we need to call the witness back again to the stand or not. So we're going to have all these processes starting all over again because Advocate Mpofu is not given a chance to finish. So can we please abide by the own directives that we adopted as a committee and some of us we did not agree to, but they were voted for and we agreed to continue. But we can't now be the same people who adopted the same directives who are now contravening the same directives. It's not fair, Chair. Can you please chair this committee in fairness? I thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Maute. Honorable Zongole?
Chair, thank you. Some of the issues have been addressed by Honorable Maute, and I did address them initially, so I'm not going to repeat them. However, I want to focus on one point that says I want it to be registered to the committee, the public, and everyone that is watching this, that you as a chairperson of this committee, you are not fair. You as a chairperson of this committee, you are emotional when it comes to dealing and running this process. I'll make mention of this one incident where I am raising an issue that affects the procedure in which should be followed. I'm raising an issue in accordance to the directives. Your response is saying I'm a spokesperson of the legal of the public protector. Your response is saying I pretend to represent them. Now, you are making insinuations that my participation in this committee, it is not based on my role as a member of parliament, but my participation in this committee is based on me being a spokesperson of the public protector. And I find that out of order. I find that degrading. I find that undermining. And I find that you as a chairperson, throughout this entire process, it appears as if you have a predetermined outcome. You have a predetermined outcome that this process must take. That is why if a person is raising an issue of fairness, you want to quickly silence me. You want to make wild insinuations about me. So I wanted to register, Chair, that if this process is going to continue the way you are driving this process, then it will spell out that this entire process is a witch hunt against Advocate Mkhwebane by the manner in which you are running this process. So I want to appeal to you firstly that you need to be fair as a chairperson. You may not agree with all of us. We are not here to agree with you. We are here to serve the people of our country. However, as a chairperson, that does not give you powers to act as if ungutata wethu and ungutixo thile apho xa kuthethe wena wonke umuntu ufuneka landele izwi lakho. Secondly, Chair, I will be writing to the speaker and raise the fact that you are biased and you are not fair and you are chairing this process in a manner that does not give confidence that indeed it is an objective, fair process. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Zungula. Honorable Hendricks.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Honorable Chair, I think you've been very fair. Secondly, Honorable Chair, Al-Jamaa stands with the way you are conducting all these proceedings. We are not gonna have a long, drawn-out inquiry, and that's why the chairman must give leadership. And I just want to thank you for your leadership. And yes, there are directives which serves as guidelines, but there's also a chair. And the chair has to look at being fair, not only to the public protector, but fair to members and fair to the nation and fair to parliament. Yes, I will also write to the speaker to tell the speaker, Honorable Chair, that we are very happy with the way you are conducting these proceedings. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Hendricks. Honorable Nadat.
No, thank you very much, Chair. Chair, we've got directives that have been adopted here, and we must not read them to suit a certain narrative. Directive 6.4 is very clear, that the chairperson gives a certain time allocation for questioning. It is read with the following directives that go as far as cross-examination in 6.8, and that there can be a time limitation that you give as a chairperson when it comes to cross-examination. Whether you're in a court of law, whether you're at home, whatever you are, there's always a time limit that is set for certain things. And but we're here to run a fair process, and the process must be fair to all that are involved in it. And I feel as if you've been sitting in that chair, in most instances, very fair. And our role here as members of parliament is to also interact with the witnesses that are being cross-examined in line with the same directives. So when we throw the word fairness and bias, you know, I feel like sometimes we just throw them for the sake of throwing them because, you know, we might define them differently. But we're all sitting here. The nation is also watching. So it's important for us to not read things retrospectively to suit our own narratives. But I want to reassure you, Chair, that as members, particularly myself as a member sitting on this committee, is that we want to run a very fair process to ensure that we conclude it, to ensure that we are fair to Advocate Mkhwebane and whoever else is involved in this particular process. Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you. Honorable Ngosi. Honorable Begging Ngosi, you are mute.
My apologies, Chairperson. Good morning, Chairperson and members of the committee. Firstly, Chair, I just want to affirm the fact that we're working according to the directives as agreed. My recollection, when we ended the meeting yesterday, you indicated to all that today you are going to prioritize questioning by members in the morning, and then in the afternoon we will go back to the first witness. There was no objection at that point to what you were saying, and nobody raised issue with that. Second, and which is important for me, is that sitting there as a chairperson, based on the directive and any discretion that you may wish to exercise, you are empowered thereto by these directives. And any objections that may be raised should be raised, of course, following the correct procedure adopted by the committee, and that it is availed to everybody that participate in that committee to raise objections based on the directives. But doing so should not impede the progress that the committee is supposed to make in as far as ensuring that it hears both the public protector and the evidence leaders. And in this regard, Chairperson, I think with regard to the current issue, I think you are exercising your discretion. I am satisfied that you have pre-warned us yesterday and that you are indeed exercising that discretion now and continuing. Any objections, therefore, should follow after, in my view, you have exercised your discretion. Lastly, Chair, I think that this is it's an important process, and I don't think that in the past 2 weeks or so, you have acted in a manner that suggests bias or a confirmation bias in regard with regard to any other thing before ourselves. I think we should continue in that regard. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Ngosi. Just the last two hands, Honorable Majozi and then Honorable Melde, and then that's a new one. Okay. Honorable Majozi?
No, thank you, Chairperson. My apologies. Can I keep my video off? We don't have electricity. We've got a problem with our substation. So I'm afraid that if I do switch on my video, maybe you will not hear me. But nonetheless, Chairperson, I would like to plead to members that as much as we are saying that the public is watching and we want to keep the decorum of the house as well, let us keep the respect that we've been showing all this time, and the fact that I do agree with other members that both sides were given an opportunity of a full day to cross-examine the people that were on the stand. And also let us maybe remove the fact that we came maybe from different political parties and maybe we came with different outcomes. Let us follow the process of this ad hoc committee. Let us follow the process that we had set before we even started this process, that what is it that we are going to do. So as much as they both parties were given chance and opportunity to cross-examine, and now let the other process unfold and we continue. Because now if we allow unprecedented things to happen today, which means even tomorrow with another a person that will be taking the stand, it will have to be the same thing. And if another party asks for more time, which means we will have to give them as well. So let us proceed with the way we have been proceeding and follow the process the way we have been doing. I don't have a problem the way we have been chairing, Chairperson. I am quite I think you have been very fair in terms of the process that you have undertaken, but let us keep the decorum of the house. And maybe there are ways that we shouldn't be using those words are not words that we should be using in a committee. I mean, we are all adults here. We must respect one another in the same way. I'm not saying how people must talk, but I'm just alerting people that even the public is watching. So what we say and how we behave will be taken upon this committee. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Majozi. Honorable Melde.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. It's Friday after a long week, and normally Fridays should be a bit more relaxed, but it doesn't seem like that. Most of the colleagues covered what I wanted to say, Chairperson, but I want to make a few points briefly. On the first day, I made the point to say that fairness will not be a ground for appeal. That's my perception. And some of the colleagues have now said they think that you've been fair. I don't think that you've been fair. We know that it's been fair. Because fairness is not only to the public protector, it's to the members of this committee as well. We've been sitting here for 2 weeks, very patiently, allowing Mr. Mpofu and the public protector to do what they need to do. But we also play a role in this process. Mr. Mpofu made the point just now that he objected to the directives. Maybe I missed that. I didn't get that objection, but maybe he did. I don't know. He also made the point that he objected to the recall of the witness. Maybe I missed that objection as well. I think the statement to say that this is not a kangaroo court is unfortunate. We said right from the beginning, this is not a court.
It's not a court. This is a parliamentary process. It's not a judicial process. It's not a court. So I think that's unfortunate. Some serious allegations are made this morning, terminology being used by some of the colleagues. It seems that it's a predetermined process. We all know that's not the case. It's being said that biased, there's no fairness. This is a witch hunt. I don't know where that comes from. I really don't know, because all of us have been part of this process. We've seen that it's a fair process. And the question is this. Is Mr. Mpofu, I made the point on the first day that, and there was an objection taken to that. Are we to sit here and if Mr. Mpofu continues and says he needs to do some cross-examination for the next 3 weeks, Parliament must just sit back and say, well, it's fine. Are you now finished? Now we'll take the next witness for another 3 weeks. No, we've got a program and the chairperson needs to do a fair process. And I think he's been fair. He's got to look at the directives and allocate the time between what is fair to the public protector, but it's also fair to the process. Members of Parliament are not here to observe. It's the committee there. We also need to participate. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Your last, Mr. Skosana.
No, thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and good morning to everybody. Yeah, Honourable Chair, well, I do sympathize with Advocate Mpofu that they might still be having some other questions and stuff. Now, however, I think we are working within the issue of time allocated because the directives that you issued, which are directives in terms of the National Assembly rules, Rule 183 to be specific. The issue of prioritizations of questions, I think from all of us, is going to be very important for Advocate Mpofu, for Advocate Bauer, even for honorable members, because even myself, I think I've got a lot of questions that I think I should ask the witness. But obviously, I won't be able to ask all the questions because we'll have to share the allocated time amongst ourselves as members. So I'll have to prioritize to say which questions do I ask and leave the others. So I think the same should apply to Advocate Mpofu and the same should apply to Advocate Bauer and the other honorable members. And I think at some point, one honorable member, if I remember correctly, Honorable Siabi, made a point that you should have a backroom meeting, yourself, Honorable Chair, Advocate Bauer, or the evidence leader and the representatives of the public protector. For instance, if Advocate Mpofu was not happy yesterday that he did not finish his question, I think after the adjournment of the session, I think you could have had that kind of a session to come to you and say, but I'm not happy, what, and then so that you discuss it amongst yourself. Perhaps today you could have had a sort of an agreement as to how you could handle it. Because now we see we're wasting time discussing this thing. I think we could have been far with the program even now. So I think that issue of backroom meeting is going to assist. But more than above that, I think my emphasis is on the issue of timelines, that we are working on the allocated time. So we must all prioritize in terms of, he might be having many questions, but he has to prioritize which questions to ask and then which one to leave because of the allocated time. That's the point that I want to make, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Skosana, and everyone else would have contributed. Yes.
Can I respond before you summarize, please?
I had given you an opportunity and I said I'm going to respond and summarize later. Now you don't want me to go there on the board.
No, oh. Chair. I have something to say. I thought it more convenient if I say it before you summarize.
Okay.
Yeah, if you don't mind. Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Just to respond to the last few points. We are fully aware that there's no unlimited amount of time. So the idea from Honorable Muda of a 3-week cross-examination is just really just an unnecessary remark if it's directed at us. We are also fully aware that the members have to interact. That's why the directives allocate the members' interaction. In all the objections we've made to the directives, which Honorable Muda seems to have missed, we have never dealt with the issue of that members must be muzzled. The only issue we're raising is at what point that should happen. I don't think anyone who is honest came here this morning thinking that the cross-examination is not going to continue. Not the witness, not the members, not the public, not the media, not the public protector. Anybody who is honest with their convictions knows that that's what we came here to do, just to continue. It doesn't matter what people might say about it. So that is the issue. The issue is that it can be, I mean, you know, I'm sure you've never seen it even in a movie.
I'm saying I'd given you an opportunity and you've made your point.
Yeah, but just before what I'm responding to was said.
And I'm asking you not to repeat what you've said before.
Okay, I won't. Thank you, Chairperson. I'm saying that no one has ever seen, when we've all seen people saying, I have no further questions in any process. I've never seen a process where that is not said by the person asking questions. And that's not just singing a song. It is to indicate that the point has been reached where the person asking questions has no further questions. When have you ever seen a situation where someone just says, okay, that's it. We'll sentence you to death or something before you indicate that you have your side of the story. When you say audi alteram partem, hear the other side. That's the first rule of fairness. The second rule of fairness is don't be biased. Both those rules are being breached serially in this process. And we cannot have a situation like that. Otherwise, we're just here to glorify the sitting, and then you do whatever you wanted to do, and we will sit here just out of respect for the process. But, or if I can even call it a process. But if that is what is supposed to happen, that we must just sit here, lie down, and be lynched, fine. Then let's do it. But do not call it a process of fairness. It is the most egregious breach of every known rule of fairness. And it cannot be done in the name of a parliament of our people. No. If it's going to be like that, then at least we must be told so that we know that we're just here, you know, as tourists to just sit, but not to participate in a fair process. What you are doing is unprecedented. It has never been done anywhere. I've been in this game for many decades. I've never seen it being done in any process. And I'm not just talking about courts. I'm talking about inquiries. I'm talking about commissions. I'm talking about fact-finding, inquest, whatever it is. There's never been a legal representative who's not allowed to say, I have no further questions.
Thank you.
And you just
thank you, Honorable Mbofu. Thank you, Advocate Mbofu. Thank you to all of you colleagues and honorable members, as well as yourself, Advocate Mbofu. Just to make this summary and the ruling. So when we started on Wednesday, we have given a set of time for the evidence leader who finished her evidence leading at 3:30 on Wednesday. And as you will remember, I had indicated then that was my intention that the next 2 hours were going to go into cross-examination. We all know that there were health issues with the witness. And we started the next day, which is yesterday, with Advocate Mbofu from 10 o'clock. I would have, when we started yesterday, said, I will re-examine his time at 3 o'clock yesterday, if you all remember that. And then I extended his time up to the end of the day yesterday. And I continued, and he's been spoken about that by myself. And at some point in his cross-examination, raised the issue of him continuing the next day, which I intervened on that. That there's no tomorrow. It might be another time that if you request that, that can be entertained. It's always been clear throughout the day yesterday that today I'm going to start with members interacting with the witness. And here is the thing. It's not done. Doesn't happen anywhere in any jurisdiction that in a process that we're driving, we're not running an elastic process that has no end. The reasonability of this is that it must be done within a reasonable time. And we want to achieve that. And as we achieve that, we balance that with fairness, which we have done completely so. Now, I want to repeat this point. If I give the evidence leader and say, you have from this point to that point, she needs to tailor her evidence leading within that time. If I do the same to you, Advocate Mpofu, as a legal team of the public protector, I expect you to tailor make your own cross-examination within a stipulated time. And that time has been the whole day of yesterday. The objection will be noted. But as you would know, nothing stops you, as we're going to do this afternoon, to interact with Mr. Ibrahim Hassan Ibrahim. If you still need more time, nothing stops you from raising that, but it might mean that we attend to that in the manner it should be done. But it must not. I don't want you to proceed in a manner as if you are surprised about the action that I'm taking this morning, because there can't be any surprise about that. Having said that loudly yesterday about what needs to happen. So I really want, and I'm not going to get into, because this I repeat, this is not a kangaroo court. There's no bias shown here. In fact, there's a lot of fairness and rationality in this process. So I therefore want to, and I make these two points. I've noted your objection on this, but you do know that it can't be the end of the road. If you need further time to interact with the witness, that's allowed, as we're going to be redoing that with Mr. Hassan this afternoon. So with that, colleagues, I want to proceed and in the list that I have called to ask the members to begin their interactions. Honorable Mylan.
Thank you, Chair. You're going to give me my time back.
Chair,
you have started.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Samuels, you said that the staff structure had the public protector at the top, the DPP, the CEO, and the COO, and then you were getting to the next layer?
Honorable Member. After the COO, then come the executive managers heading the different units, both at head office and for the provinces. Then comes the senior managers, provincial representatives, and other senior managers also based at head office. The rest going down.
That's fine. Thank you. So just so that I'm absolutely clear, COO, executive managers, and then provincial representatives.
Correct, Honourable Member.
Thank you. Can I just turn to the FREDA report? And there was an issue raised that certain complaints, particularly complaint number 3 from Dr. Jankelson, was not investigated or not reported. Can you give us any indication as to why that was not investigated or reported?
From my recollection, that complaint came after the so-called Gupta leaks. And by that time, we had sent our report. Initially, the public protector gave a directive or instruction that we must, I think he gave it to the CEO to say that part must also be investigated. But at a later stage, a few weeks or a few days thereafter, that was changed to say that they should not be investigated.
Thank you. Was any reason provided for not subpoenaing Premier Makashula and MEC Zwane?
No.
No reason, no reason provided.
Was given, yeah.
Thank you. And was any reason given for the exclusion of the findings or remedial action against those individuals?
No, not to me.
With regard to the beneficiaries of the Fela Dairy Project, why did the public protector not consult those beneficiaries?
I know it during the reinvestigation, which was now done by her at head office, there was an interaction with those beneficiaries. But from our end, earlier on, we had spoken to, or at least my predecessor in the Free State office had spoken and interviewed the leader of the group of beneficiaries who subsequently died. And from, you know, also from our end, we did not deem it necessary to interview each and everyone because that was the leader who was representing all of them. So that was done in part. It's just that, and when we asked during the, you know, when arranging the inspection in loco on the 10th of April 2017, when we asked the public protector through her PA whether we should call the beneficiaries to be present at the inspection, and with a view that she should, if she wants, interact with them, seeing that would be there, you know, already. Her response was that it's not necessary to do that.
Yeah. In regard to that, the email, it's SS30 in your bundle. The email from Ephraim in Kabindi, you indicated already that this person was the public protector's personal assistant. Is that correct?
Correct, yes.
Did that person give you an instruction that the beneficiaries were not to be included in the visit by the public protector?
His response to that question, because we specifically asked him to communicate to the public protector and ask if we should ask the beneficiaries to come. His response was, in our view, an instruction from the public protector, because I don't believe he would have made that decision on his own. The response we understood to mean that the public protector does not think it necessary for them to.
Can I refer you to that email? Yes. It's page 2529, SS30.
Yes, I'm there.
If you have a look at the response, it says, "Dear Erica, no need to invite the complainant and delegation beneficiaries, regards," and it's sent to you by Ephraim Kabindi. Is there anything there that indicates that that instruction came from the public protector?
No, not from that email.
Okay. Mr. Samuels, I'm asking you to maybe speculate a little bit here, but if you know, perhaps you could answer. Why were the findings of non-compliance by the department contained in the draft provisional report removed?
So I'm going to ask that you please repeat the questions.
Yeah. In the draft provisional report, there were findings of non-compliance by the Department of Agriculture in the Free State.
Yes.
Those were removed subsequently. Why were they removed?
I cannot recall, really. Are you referring to the November 2014 report?
That's correct, yes.
Oh, yes. That one was, I cannot recall, because it was sent through when I was still in Limpopo.
Okay.
So when I went through to the Free State, I did not, I never inquired about that. I just took the report as it was discussed in the think tank, to continue from there.
Mr. Samuel, do you know if there was an appeal against the Estina judgment?
Yes.
There was an appeal? There was,
yes.
Okay, and what was the outcome of that appeal?
No, not an appeal. I think we should, I'm talking about the review.
There was a review finding.
To set it aside.
There was a review to set it aside. Was that review appealed?
Yes, it was.
And what was the outcome of that appeal?
It was not successful.
Thank you. I just want to move on to, you raised the issue of legal costs and how they had ballooned. What caused that ballooning of legal costs? You said the Public Protector's Office became more litigious, but why did it become more litigious?
There was no reason provided, and that was why I questioned, why we were suddenly involved in so much litigation when the practice or the approach up to then had been that we are not a litigious institution, and that we've always been complaining about our budget being insufficient. So the involvement in litigation meant that other programs suffered. The money was redirected.
Okay. Do you have any knowledge of which law firms and or advocates were utilized by the Office of the Public Protector in the period 2016 to date?
No, I cannot recall that out of hand now.
Was there a panel of law firms, or was it one or two? If you don't know, that's
also... I can't recall, but I think there were more than one.
Okay.
Last one.
I've got two questions, Chair.
Okay.
With regard to the reinvestigation into the Frieda Dairy project, did it commence de novo when that took place, or did they use the information that had already been gathered and then add to it?
Seeing that we are not involved in that part, I cannot say that they, it was started de novo, but at least in as far as the politicians and their role was concerned, yes, certainly it started de novo.
Just in that particular part?
Yes, okay. Because that was the main crux for the reinvestigation.
Last question from me. And I'm referring specifically to the meeting that was held between the Public Protector and Premier Magashule. Is it normal for meetings between the Public Protector, or is it, first of all, is it normal for the Public Protector to have meetings with implicated persons like that? And as a consequence, if the Public Protector had such a meeting, would that have normally been minuted and recorded?
Yes, firstly, it is normal for the Public Protector to have such meetings with implicated parties, but that would be an investigative meeting, which should then involve the officials from her office investigating that implicated party. And because it would be an investigative meeting, it would have to be recorded, at minutes taken and voice recordings as well.
Thank you, Mr. Sanders.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mylan. Before I go to Mr. Heron, I see Honorable Zungula, you have your hand up.
Chairperson, in your earlier exchanges, you had stated that I'm a spokesperson and I purport or pretend to represent advocating both. And I find that, firstly, it is unparliamentary and it is degrading to me as a member of parliament. So I wanted you to withdraw on that, withdraw that and make a ruling that you were out of order.
Thank you, Honorable Zungula. Your order is not sustained. I proceed. Honorable Heron.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mr. Samuels, I want to understand the investigative process that you undertake in the Office of the Public Protector, and how do you get to identify implicated persons?
The investigative process generally starts with drafting an investigation plan, looking at the allegations being made. We determine whether or not this will be a protracted investigation, and so that because we have timelines for specific investigations. And in terms of that project plan, we then set milestones, you know, within which we should have achieved certain aspects. And it happens, you know, in the initial complaint, there would be allegations made about specific people, but in some cases not. And during the course of an investigation, we would then pick that up, that someone else is being implicated. And so we would not ignore that, we would have to pursue that aspect.
Thank you. And I think your evidence was that if implicated persons were politicians, then the case would be regarded as politically sensitive. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah.
So what was the initial complaint in the Frieda Dairy investigation?
Initially, it was about the, you know, it was about the conduct of the department, specifically the HOD, in expending the amounts of money that they had, you know, paid out to. Gather my thoughts there. It was to the Estina. Yes, but effectively, it did not mention any politician specifically. And later on, in our interaction with the complainant, Mr. Roy Jenkinson, it then transpired that he's in effect. Complaining about the role of politicians in the whole process.
And I think your evidence was, and your affidavit contains several references to it, that the lead investigator was Advocate Saliers.
That is correct.
And that when you arrived at the Free State office, there was a November 2014 report that had been drafted by Advocate Saliers.
That's correct, yes.
And that report didn't include implicated persons who were politicians?
Yes, it did not.
Did not?
It did not.
And it was Advocate Madonsela who wanted further investigation into the politicians?
It was in the course of our discussions in the think tank that it came about that there was a role of, the report does not look into the role of politicians. She would have had interactions with the politician, specifically the complainant, because any follow-ups or delays or perceived delays would be raised with her.
So why would Advocate Saliers' report not identify politicians if she was following the investigative process and presented a draft of a report that didn't include politicians?
I cannot answer that question because at that stage I was not involved with the investigation. I was only involved from the time it was discussed at the think tank. But in my discussions with her, she always regarded, because even subsequent to that, she always argued that this was an administrative complaint, not a political complaint.
So would it be fair to conclude that the evidence and the investigation that she was pursuing didn't identify any politicians, and that's why she excluded them from her November 2014 draft?
No, it did. It did, but it only limited those findings to their failure to take action against or to oversee to implement the recommendations of the investigation that was done by the by Treasure.
So then,
I can't remember the exact term, accountant general or something.
So then why did Advocate Martin Seller have to ask you twice? I think you said you gave evidence that she even phoned you on one occasion to say that you need to take over this investigation because there's not sufficient findings around, or not sufficient investigation around politicians.
I cannot explain from her, from her perspective, but she felt that, we were not delving deeper into the issues, to see, if we can find any direct evidence that they were involved in the investigation. She was by no means suggesting that they were. She just said, investigate it, and whatever your finding is, it should suffice, because we, by that time it was already in growing interest from the media and the public.
But Advocate Salias hadn't found any or hadn't made sufficient findings.
That's because she had not investigated them.
And we heard from Mr. Kakana that Advocate Salias was removed from the case because she was a DA member.
To my knowledge, I don't have knowledge that she was a member of any political party.
Because it would be strange that if she was a DA member removed from the case and there's a DA complainant, that she didn't find anything against politicians.
I would think so, yes. That if she was a DA member, as alleged, the insinuation would be that she would also have an interest in finding against the politicians.
Particularly if there's a complaint from a DA member part of the provincial legislature.
Yes.
Okay. I just want to move on quickly, if I may, to the Rule 53 record, which you say you looked at the record filed and you were surprised there was only a November 2014 report as part of the Rule 53 record.
Yes.
Do you know offhand how many drafts of this report there were? Maybe I can. I've gone through your affidavit. Maybe I can help, and you can tell me if this is correct. I have November 2016 drafted by Advocate Saliers.
Yes.
And then there's a March 2017 that was drafted by Advocate Matlawe and was regarded as a provisional report.
Yes.
And then in April 2017. Also drafted by Advocate Saliers. Am I correct?
Correct, yes.
And there was a July report, but it was called, you call it a July report, but it was, or it was called a July report, but it was drafted in August, also by Advocate Saliers.
Correct, yes.
And then there was a September 2017 report, also drafted by Advocate Saliers, but drafted in August.
Yes.
And then there was a report which you referred to yourself as having being involved in a revised draft in 2017, but you can't find that report.
That's correct.
So that's about six reports that you would say should have been in the Rule 53 and were not in the Rule 53 record.
Yes, that would be the case. The point I made, and I'm still making now, is that there was a lot of to and fro about these reports. I certainly understand if it is confusing on anyone, because sometimes it is confusing to myself as well. You know, I have to gather my thoughts to know which report, was which. The way I could isolate whether, moving from one report to the other was, what the differences were, was to employ a feature that was on my laptop to compare the two and let it, so to speak, do the reading for me and say what is in the new report that is not in the old one. But with my report, with my laptop being confiscated, subsequent to that, I could not follow the trend of
the report. Finally, your file was requested and sent to the head office also, I think, in 2017, you said.
Correct, yes.
So all of these reports, these six or seven reports that were various versions of this draft report or provisional report, would there have been copies in that file? Would you have made a copy of each of those reports?
Yes, they would have been there.
So the exclusion from the Rule 53 record in your mind, how did that happen?
I have no idea. I found it surprising. I was not involved in the preparation of that 53 record. But when it was brought to my attention, I was surprised that why would you go to the very initial report and make it as if that was the only report that was considered or the final report signed off that was being appealed or reviewed was in fact the 2014 one. I could not understand that.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Heron. I now recognize Honorable Manani, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning, colleagues. Kya homogela ntate Samuel. Potso ya ka ya ntlha mo go wena ke go botsa gore ke khola nna from my side that you are here on behalf of the public and as well to help us as the committee. Ke batla go checka le wena gore o netefatse gore go teng ga gago fa ga se go ipuseletsa na, according to the grievances that you have raised on your affidavit. That's my first question for you.
Thank you, Honorable Member. I have stated that it was out of concern for the escalating legal fees that my gripe first started. And I've said, and I've repeated now, I don't have anything personal against Advocate Mukhwebane. I have my views about her and her conduct, but they have nothing to do with me, with me having been dismissed by the office or any action taken about me. I am here solely to assist the committee at its request, in the sense that my initial affidavit had made allegations that they felt would need to be answered to and presented to the committee.
Okay. According to you, with the concerns that you have raised on your affidavit in terms of paragraph 139.3, have you tried to actually raise those issues within the institution, more especially with those that you are working with, the think tanks? Have you tried to raise your issues with regards to whatever that you felt that you feel that you are not satisfied as a subordinate in the institution?
Just to be certain, Honorable Member, I want to understand. Paragraph 139.3 talks to the meeting that the PP had
with the Premier.
Yes. No, I did not. I discussed it with my line manager, Advocate Ndou, to say that this happened. But I did not raise any concern as in a complaint or say a grievance about it. No, I did not.
And then my other question is with regards to paragraph 193. You indicate your issue of, like, for me, it's as if you are surprised that in 20 years, you've been subjected to disciplinary measures and so on. And one would want to check as well, noting what you have raised on the speaker's letter with regards to the issue of intelligence of the public protector. For me, when you read the affidavit from my side, one would indicate that there were some tensions with regards to you being submissive in terms of the orders within the institution. However, one would want to know that, like, with whatever that has been happening in the institutions, in the institution of the public protector, don't you think that some of the people can be, I think that you were, there was some little bit of subordination from your side, taking order from a female with in higher in terms of the authority in the workplace. So don't you think that people can think that you are an individual or a male who believes that they cannot be led by a female in an institution?
I do not agree with that. I have no problem with being led by a female or by a woman. I have been led by them previously, notably my line managers in the past, and notably the ex public protector Advocate Matonsel, whom I hold in high regard. I've learned a lot from her and others. I have no issues or qualms about being led by or taking instructions from my immediate boss, so to speak, anyone who's above me. My feelings as to whether whoever gives me an instruction is a male or female have got nothing to do with my professional work. In a professional environment, there are different classes of authority, and I subject myself to those.
Okay, thank you, sir. Then my other question is with regards to your conclusion of your affidavit. One would want to check that, do you believe the incumbent PP has brought shame and dishonor to the office of the PP with her conduct?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And then my last one, Chair, is that in the circumstances you related, do you believe that the PP conducted herself improperly and has brought the office of the public protector in disrepute?
My understanding of bringing an institution into disrepute might really be subjective. I can only go as far as saying, based on her conduct, overall conduct, especially as it reflected in the public, following from her conduct, generally as in being involved in this litigation being reported on in the media, it has eroded the trust that people had of the office and their reliance on whether or not their complaints would be attended was definitely dented. I mean, we do interact with people on the ground, and some do question whether or not we are behind giving the public protector this kind of support of advice. And it's a reflection of how they perceive the office, given those negative comments or the negative publicity around her conduct.
Okay. No, thank you, Jay.
Thank you, Honorable Malanisa. I now recognize Honorable Sukas.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Samuel, I have three questions. I first want to ask, just to add to what was asked previously, did the shadow of Tuli Madonsela loom large over the new public protector as she entered the role?
I would say yes, it did.
And to what extent did that influence the expectations of managers or investigators?
I believe it's natural, or maybe speaking, you know, for myself, it is natural for anyone to react to change in, you know, by comparing generally where we come from or where we are at that time to the new change, you know, as in the new incumbent coming in. It happened, you know, with the transition between Advocate Mushwana and Advocate Madonsela, you know, but immediately we get to interact with the new incumbent, and we get to know his or her vision about the office. It allays some fears. Most certainly, with the arrival of Advocate Mkhwebane, speaking for myself personally and having worked with her previously when we were both senior investigators, and we were also involved in starting representation of all the workers in the office. We started off serving in a staff association together. My expectation and everyone else's was that she's coming into the office, you know, knowing what generally the issues are, and that she would, you know, be, you know, she would treat everyone with the respect and sort of listen to what our issues were. You know. And the first few weeks, we were battling with getting our salaries or our salary packages translated from, you know, into the LP scales. And that was a grievance that we had with Advocate Madonsela. And so when she came in, that was one of the first things that she attended to. And it was resolved. And so it was an indication for us that at least she's listening, and she's, you know, she's listening to us as workers. But definitely, you know, there was apprehension at first. You know, we didn't know how to handle the change. But as soon as we got to interact with her, we then eased into working with her.
So it settled down.
Yes, it settled down.
You claim that the public protector was exposed during the think tank sessions. Can you give examples of when this occurred?
I've referred to an example in my initial affidavit that, you know, we had robust discussions in the think tank, and everyone was supposed to voice out, you know, to have read the reports, including the public protector, and then, you know, debate issues, whether the facts supported the, you know, or the law supported the facts as we would read the reports. And we would not agree, even during Advocate Madonsela's time, we would not agree, you know, with, you know, completely with everything. At times, I'm speaking now, let me start with Advocate Madonsela. She would, for instance, disagree with us on certain conclusions that we're drawing and what the report should be like. And she would give in and say, okay, I'll go with the majority, you know, with what she... But sometimes where she felt strongly that she could not defend what the majority was saying, if there was a backlash, she would then persuade us to go with her thinking. And the justification, therefore, was that eventually she's the public protector. She's the one who's going to have to face the backlash about that, and would accept that and take it as providing leadership, which was by contrast not the case when Advocate Mkhwebane continued with the think tank. I make the point that we would again continue with these debates, and we obviously have different views and would argue differently about cases. And she would go, she'd go along with a particular view. And, as the discussions, progress, a different view would come and she would then jump and follow that to the extent that, we then perceive there as not providing leadership and so that we can take a decisive action about a report. Perhaps it might have been unfair in that we were comparing her, mm-hmm. to a predecessor, but that is generally how it was. So to the extent that she had a daunting task in filling those boots, I think it was natural for us to compare that to what the office was before and what it was in when she came in.
Okay. You have worked for over 20 years in the Office of the Public Protector and with a number of public protectors.
Correct, with all of them.
So have the number of labor and labor disputes with staff and members being dismissed or being subject to legal action in labor matters, how did that... How did it occur under the different public protectors versus Advocate Mkhwebane? What was the and I may ask you now a question that you don't readily have an answer for, but in your experience, how did the numbers of those instances of disciplinary action, dismissals, legal action being taken by members of staff, how did it compare?
Yes, I'm able to answer that question. There were disciplinary actions taken against members of staff at different times throughout the certainly the three public protectors. The first one, Advocate or a Judge Bakwa now, it was characterized mostly by establishing the office, really. There were not many. We didn't even have a fully fledged HR unit. It was only one person doing an HR function. But as the years, got on, we started, we had policies and things, and directives in place, which amongst them was the disciplinary code and disciplinary policy. But the cases were there, but they were not as many as they became during Advocate Mkhwebane's reign. I remember, I would chair some of the disciplinary hearings against staff members. I've had some, in other provinces as in KZN, even here in Cape Town. I've presided over those, and the general trend then, the numbers were, the outcomes did not lead to dismissals. Where they did, the dismissal would have to be confirmed by the public protector. Notably with Advocate Madonsela, she would overturn a lot of those, and her view was that we must find an alternative. She's not going to be responsible for denying someone and his family his livelihood when that person can be rehabilitated. And her attitude was really a motherly one, to say that when you consider that kind of a sanction, it must really be justified. I mean, as in dishonesty with money, and so on, that goes to the trust, of the employer in relation to that employee. So that was the trend. Equally now, after, with Advocate Mkhwebane, All dismissals must be confirmed by her, but there were quite a lot of those. I'm one of the casualties. My colleagues who will also come and testify are some of them. There was a particular direction that was the outcome she wanted with all the disciplinary actions. I'm saying this because all of those disciplinary actions taken, at least against senior managers and some in middle management, have led to dismissals, which was a departure from the previous one's attitude that, we have to be very careful and not jump to that kind of a sanction unless it is completely justified.
Okay. Mr. Samuel, what has brought you here?
I was requested to come to the committee, and with that request being made, I felt that it was my duty to comply and come and assist the committee. That was how it was put to me, that would you be willing to come and assist the committee, because you have deposed to an affidavit making some allegations which are viewed to be relevant to what this committee is going to do. And so I agreed that I would comply.
Thank you for coming, and thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Honorable.
Thank you, Honorable Sukas. The next member is Honorable Madada, but we are going to pause before we go to him so that we don't break his questioning time. We'll take a 15-minute break, tea break, and be back at 11:45, and we'll start with Honorable Madada. Again for 15 recording minutes. Stopped.
We're back from the tea break, colleagues. Let me check in the virtual if they're still with us. Honorable Mautwe, are you there?
I'm here, Chair. Thank you.
Recording in progress.
Thank you. Before break, I'd recognize Honorable Nodada. You have the platform.
Thank you so much, Chair. Morning, Mr. Semai.
Good morning, Honorable Member.
I just have a few questions for you, Shagaz. Mr. Semai, you indicated to us that at some point in time you were suspended from position and then later on reinstated after having taken course with the CCMA. What were your reasons for being reinstated?
Yes, indeed, I was suspended and eventually dismissed in 2020. But I was dismissed following an internal disciplinary hearing that I could only attend for the first day and the subsequent 5 days or so. It was postponed to a later date. I did not participate in the hearing during those days, and I was eventually found guilty. The hearing continued, and I was found guilty in absentia based on the evidence that was there. I then challenged that to the CCMA. We went all the way to the arbitration, and effectively the hearing started from scratch there, and I was exonerated on all the charges.
All right. Since you were exonerated from all charges, does this reinforce your belief that your dismissal was because you asked the public protector to resign, or part of the reasons thereof?
Yes, it does.
Why do you say that?
Because that action was taken, the action to discipline me was taken only after I had asked the speaker to launch an investigation, and effectively, notably against the public protector as the head of the institution and perhaps some of the operations within the office. Even the comments from the commissioner were that employers must not discipline in anger, and that is exactly what his observations were, that Advocate Mkhwebane took issue with me because she was angry about the fact that I had lost this complaint against her and the fact that that complaint had found its way in the media.
All right. Now, just going to some of the stuff that you mentioned around the investigation on the Freda report, you mentioned that there were findings that you initially made against politicians but were subsequently removed from the report, particularly on Mr. Ace Magashule and Mr. Mosebenzi Zwane. What were those findings that were initially removed from the draft report?
In addition to the findings that were made even prior to that final report that I sent, there were findings against politicians, but they related only to their failure to take action as recommended in the earlier report of the AG. But the findings that I made that I say were removed were the findings, specific findings to the effect that both politicians cannot be divorced from liability simply because there was an HOD as the accounting officer that was the face of what happened with that project. He could not have been acting alone. He must have acted in concert with the politicians, or at least on instructions from the politicians, particularly because they refused, to cooperate or give their, subject themselves to the investigation. And, I then proceeded to find against them based on the available information, which included, as I said, the Hansard, the speeches they made in the legislature, as well as the public speeches that they had made, which effectively owned up, you know, where they were saying they're taking ownership of the project and projecting it to the public as their project, their you know, it doing what they were doing for the community.
And the public protector, after, as you mentioned, have evidence that she then reinvestigated, you know, after certain pressure on that particular component of that report, is where you were indicating that she took about 18 months to 2 years. Were the findings of the public protector any different from what you found?
No, they were not. I felt largely that they did cover that what I had found. And so, you know, they were not supposed to be driven removed in the first place. But, you know, at least this time she had, in fact, interacted with, according to the report, with the politicians concerned.
All right. Now, can we just come to the core of what you gave evidence on around what you term as a reckless and poorly considered litigation? Could you just maybe state for the record as to what are the examples of what you refer to when you make a reference to reckless or poor considered litigation?
I'm referring to the cases that were decided up to that time that I lodged this initial affidavit. Notably, the comments made by the judges about her conduct in pursuing that kind of litigation, and the fact that she relentlessly pursued that litigation from in all forums up to the highest court, and that would be the investigations against the president, against Mr. Pravin Gordhan, and so on. They were very topical at the time. And it was a departure from, with the adverse findings made against her, they had more of a negative, effect than a positive image for the office. And generally, her attitude was that, in one instance, I can't remember, in which report it was. I think, but she's reported to have said to Mr. Nemesis, or Mr. Matlawe, that we might be taken on review, about the report as it stands. I can't remember which report it was, and her standard reply would be, let them take me on review, and it was a question of not considering whether it was worth it or not. It was just an approach that they can take me wherever they want. And the fact that she went all the way, irrespective of the fact that even personal calls were being made against her, I perceive that to be really reckless and not improving, what we should be, anything positive for the office. It was, in fact, a negative.
Just on that, Mr. Summer, if you just go to top page 2079 of your affidavit, particularly points 26.1.1. Are you there?
Yes.
Cool. Just on what you've just mentioned now, 26.1.1, the second sentence as it reads there, the public protector caused the Office of the Public Protector to oppose most of the applications on face of where and should obviously have been understood as insurmountable grounds of review that would have made the outcomes inevitable. Is this in relation to what you've just mentioned now? Whether that this should have been taken into account when dealing with these particular cases, and in particular South African Reserve Bank issue.
Yes, it is. It does. It is in relation to that. a decision to challenge any finding against you, either as a person or as an institution, must be taken in the best interests of your best interest or in the best interest of the organization. And if one looks at the kind of issues that were being raised in challenging these decisions, one would have to make an assessment of whether or not you stood a good chance of winning, and not just winning, whether it is necessary to oppose any application for a review. There are some cases where we did not oppose any applications for review, and they would end up being decided in our favor, effectively confirming that the office was right in making that kind of a finding. Yes, this was ill-conceived in the sense that it did not take into account whether we had chances or we were entitled to make the remedial action that was being appealed against.
Cool. My second last question, Mr. Samuels. I'm going to refer you to certain sections of your affidavit, but it's around particularly what this committee has been asked to do. Yesterday, there was a narrative painted by or led by Mr. Mpofu around accepting decisions made by the courts or magistrates making certain legal findings or decisions on individuals, and he was referring to your case in which you have appealed. Now, would it be fair for this committee, if you read on 2.26.1.2, where you indicate that the public protector made disingenuous arguments, failed to observe the requirements of fairness during her investigation, and could reasonably be suspected of having been biased in the investigation when reading from the court judgments? Would it there be a fair conclusion that the committee should make since that decision was made by the High Court?
Yes, I was merely repeating what the courts were saying and the effect that they were having on the institution.
So would it be fair for us to conclude so, as advised that the decisions of the court, we must accept because it's made by a certain magistrate. So if we read these court judgments, would it be fair for us to take this conclusion that the PP might have been disingenuous in her arguments, she may be unreasonable in her investigation and biased?
Oh, okay. I might have misunderstood your question, but yes, now that I understand it, my view is that you are making an independent assessment, and the case being made against the public protector, is based on those judgments and what what effect they had on the institution. It is, I believe, up to the committee to take them into consideration or to reject them. But what remains is that they were made and those cases have been finalized. So as to whether they will add value to the assessment of this committee, it's really up to the committee to decide.
Let me put the question lastly to you this way. Would it be fair for an ordinary South African who is maybe reading these judgments to come to the conclusion of what the High Court, the Supreme Court of Appeal, and the Constitutional Court have on various different cases, whether it be the CX case, whether it be the president-related case, whether it be the Fred Adiera report case, where courts have made remarks that the public protector failed to exercise her duties without bias. They even go as far as saying, for example, the Fred Adiera report has unduly and dramatically narrowed the scope, failed to investigate thoroughly and use information at disposal. So as an ordinary South African who's reading all of these that you have now cited as specific examples in what you call reckless and poorly advised litigation, would it be fair for them to draw those conclusions that were made by the court reading from this?
Honourable Member, my view is that these comments are out there. They cannot be ignored. It would then be up to the whoever consumes this information, as in the public, as you say, to decide whether or not these they view them to be reasonable or fair to be considered. I generally have I don't have any control over that, but because it depends from one person to the other. But for me, the cumulative effect of these comments certainly make one think thoroughly whether or not this institution is being led by a person who's fit to lead it. And I would say in and of themselves, these comments, they are not grounds for her to be removed or impeached, but they can they should certainly be taken into account to the extent that they are helpful to the committee.
No, thanks, Mr. Samuel. I'm just asking those questions because there was a certain narrative led yesterday that if a magistrate has ruled on something in the courts, we must take it as is, and if someone has been found to be guilty of assaulting someone, they're criminal. So if these findings, if that is the case, then they should be considered. But in any case,
I thought you had your last question.
Okay, I was going to ask something. I'm state on the record that I do have quite a few questions for the PP as well. Thanks.
Thank you. At least that's on the record. Thank you. Honorable Hendricks.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Mr. Samuel, thank you for responding and coming before the committee to give evidence. It is indeed appreciated. Mr. Samuel, in your view, the new public protector did not really make the cut for the appointment. Was it your view that a panel interviewing her did not know what they were doing? Was her appointment rather not a need to shake up the office, as the outgoing public protector was, in your words, a motherly figure? And maybe what was now needed was a fatherly figure to deal with errant staff, which seems to have been a feature in that particular office, and need for very strong disciplinary action to put the office on a new narrative. Mr. Samuel, four of the public protectors' determinations.
Just a pause, Honorable Hendricks. The witness, Mr. Samuel, had asked that if you could please just do your questions one by one so that he can respond adequately to your questions before you go to the next one.
I understand.
Just repeat the first one for him, please.
The first question is, I thank Mr. Samuel. And then the question is, in your view, the new public protector did not make the cut. Was it your view that a panel interviewing her did not know what they were looking and what they were doing and looking for? Was her appointment maybe not a need to shake up the office, bring in a different kind of person, as the outgoing public protector was a motherly figure, which you seem to like, and that what was now needed was a fatherly figure to deal with errant staff? Because it appears just from what we've heard so far that there were a lot of errant staff in the office of the public protector that the previous public protector had to deal with, and the new public protector had a different style to deal with it.
Thank you. Let's pause there. Mr. Samuel.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honorable Member. I'm one of the people that were in support of her being appointed. I admit, and I said this to my colleagues as well, knowing her from previous from the fact that we worked together, and her performance at the interviews was, in my view, was excellent. And I, after having, you know, listened to all the interviews and watched, I also came to the conclusion that she has aced it, and we were all happy. I was, but it is her conduct subsequent to that during her term that then, you know, turned around. Certainly at the time she was appointed, she deserved it. It is only practically now when doing her work and taking decisions that, you know, that view changed.
Thank you. Back to you, Honorable Hendricks.
Honorable Chair, four of the public protector's determinations are the subject of this inquiry. In at least one of them, Mr. Samuel, you were very closely involved. Can you list for the committee the long list of positions or people that were involved, including even the think tank, before she finally signed off? And we now have a determination that she's not fit for office and that she must be fired. Now, why should all of them involved in the loop, in the chain, not be disciplined for contributing to a determination the Democratic Alliance considered horrific enough to ask this committee to recommend to Parliament to fire her? When everything was approved, they even corked champagne bottles. If it was horrific, should there not be a lesser penalty other than firing, which you say was a hallmark of the previous public protector, the so-called mother? Because so many people are involved, should she not rather be disciplined? I don't know if there is such provision, but assume there is. Is discipline, for example, not better than suspension, and obviously not better than firing? A narrative or a position that you seem to support.
I was lost there. Thank you, Honorable Member, but I was lost a bit there. But at least the last part means that I'm actually understanding the question. I think you will tell me if I, in my answer, whether I'm actually addressing that. But for me, really, it is not for me to decide or to determine whether he should be dismissed, maybe to borrow from your words, or not. It is for the committee and eventually the National Assembly. If we look at my initial complaint or my request, it was for an investigation to be commenced. And the investigation could have exonerated her or even found that my allegations were correct, or others that, you know, might come forward and launch their own complaints. Equally with this committee, if at the end of the whole process the committee feels that there are insufficient grounds or, you know, to justify from the, you know, terms of this committee that she should be impeached, it is an outcome that follows a fair process, and to that extent, you know, I will accept it. I have my views as to whether she, you know, she's fit or not to run that office, which I've made clear. But my views are not in any way to be taken as dictating to the committee that she should be removed. It is a determination that is going to be made by the committee.
The question that you missed, and I'm sorry that it was a very long question, was that the public protector, when making the determination, there were so many other people involved, and I even heard that there was a think tank involved. We would like to know which people were on the think tank, if you can recall. And besides the think tank, who else were involved when the Democratic this particular matter was registered, maybe electronically, with the public protector? Can you tell us, once it was registered, normally electronically, with a public protector, who are all the names in the box that were involved that eventually it led to a think tank that was consulted. And then, you know, the buck stops with the public protector, and she made the determination, and now her head must roll, and everyone else that were involved are now scot-free. We would like to know as a committee who were all involved. Maybe they should also be sanctioned.
You got that, Ms. Summer?
Chair,
please respond. Go ahead if you have.
I will respond, you know, on the basis of how I understand the question.
Sure.
The people that are involved in the think tank or were involved are all the provincial representatives and all the heads of the investigative units at head office and the public protector and sometimes the deputy public protector as well, and some investigators, senior investigators, where it was deemed necessary that they should be, especially those based at head office, that they should come and talk to their specific reports. If any action has to be taken against them for what I understand from the question to be that they must also be held liable, I really have no answer to that. I don't agree that they are to be held liable. I was also included and participated in the think tank. Perhaps if that is how the public protector would have felt that she was misled by the think tank, it is up to her to decide whether that conduct falls within the disciplinary code and procedure and allows her to take action against all of us who serve in the think tank. That is how I understand your question.
Just the last point for clarification. So we know that you were involved, and obviously what you said, Chair, to take into account, we know that there were many, many, many members in the think tank that were involved. But before the think tank, there must have been people involved that led up to a report coming to the think tank. Can you take the committee in your conferences and tell them who these people are? Because then my view is that, they should also be put on the radar and to see if they contributed to what the DA says is a horrific finding, so bad that the public protector must be fired.
Thank you, Honorable Hendricks. Mr. Samuel?
It would be impossible for me to state who those people are, but I'm just putting it that the think tank was comprised of the people that, you know, the managers and senior investigators that I have mentioned. That was standard. They had to be there. But if I'm to mention names, it would have to be in relation to specific reports, perhaps that were discussed on specific dates. And in order to do that, I would need to go and, you know, to obtain the minutes or the attendance register for those, you know, for those sessions. So it is really, for me sitting here, impossible to mention names. Especially if there is no guideline as to when, you know, which think tank and when. And sitting here, I don't have that information.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your responses.
Thank you, Honorable Member.
Thank you, Honorable Hendricks. And I recognize Honorable Gondwe.
I don't
hear you as usual.
I was telling him that I have a few questions for him. Or not a few, but I have questions. Samuel, you stated in your oral evidence before the committee that in the course of the Freda matter being investigated, you were instructed or directed by Advocate Mokhabane not to make any adverse findings against politicians. Did she issue this instruction directly to you, or was it issued to you via your line manager? And in the issuing of this instruction, was there explicit mention of which politicians, you could not make adverse findings against. And did Advocate Makhabane also issue an instruction or a directive to the effect that you should not use the Gupta leaks emails in the course of the Freda matter investigation?
Yes, Honourable Member, on the first question or first part of the question, the instruction was given directly and orally by Advocate Makhabane to me during the Freda inspection visit, when I was asking her to authorize that I prepare subpoenas for her signature so that you can subpoena these two politicians. I mentioned them specifically at the time. And so any reference to politicians there, at least as far as the Freedom matter is concerned, only referred to the two. Mr. Ace Magashule was the premier at the time, and Mr. Museveni Zizwane, who was the member of the Executive Council for Agriculture at the time. And then subsequent to that, when I discussed it with my line manager, Mr. Ndou, he also confirmed that he was given similar instructions. So, and I understand he's perhaps going to testify. He'll probably talk to that himself. But that he also confirmed receiving a similar instruction.
The Gupta links.
The Gupta links. I think at the time that they came out and there was an exchange about them, the instruction, you know, was you know, I was on leave and on sick leave following an operation. And then, you know, I was copied in the emails, which is standard that, you know, being the provincial representative, if I had any views, whether I'm on leave or not, yes, I can chip in.
Hendricks, please mute. Honorable Hendricks, please mute for your 3 o'clock meeting. You go ahead, Mr. Samuel.
I have lost track, Chair, of where I was.
You were still explaining that.
Oh, yes, the Gupta leaks.
Yes.
I was aware of the instruction because I think in the email that gave that instruction, it was sent to the CEO so that and various other members like myself were copied there, if my recollection is that it is one of the annexures here. Maybe I could refresh by looking at it. But it was given in, you know, like in writing that we should you know, it should be done. I think the file was already at head office at the time. So it turned out that instruction, we in the Free State could not carry it out. But it was then, you know, also withdrawn. A different instruction was given subsequent to that.
Thank you. My second question is around the meeting between Advocate Makhabane and the Premier, former Premier of the Free State. Did you find it peculiar, or strange that Advocate Makhabane had a one-on-one, unminuted, unrecorded meeting with the Premier, who was invariably an implicated party in the investigation? And did she issue the instruction for you and the rest of the team not to make adverse findings against any politicians after or before this meeting with the Premier?
Thank you. I will start with the last one. That instruction was issued after she had the meeting with the Premier. Yes, I found it peculiar that, you know, she invited myself and the CEO specifically to go and introduce us to the Premier, because one of the questions she asked me when I relayed the message that the Premier wants to, you know, to have a meeting with her was that I had not, you know, she asked me whether I had met him. I said, no, I've never met him. I've made several advances just to go and introduce myself since I came from the, you know, from Limpopo, which was exactly the same, you know, gesture I had made to the Premier then. I think it was Mr. Kassel Matale and the DG of the province. So I thought, you know, it would also be good to meet them, introduce myself, and so that when we start making inquiries, when they see my name, they know who's sending these. And it was peculiar because that was the purpose. There was no, you know, at the time I didn't think that it was, and even now I don't think that it was going to be about the Freire, but it would not have been strange that it is discussed. Certainly for her meeting the premier at the time, it was normal. She was already there, and he's one of the stakeholders, or at least in relation to the one part of the purpose of her visit. She had to meet the politicians and then the members of the public. There was nothing strange with that. It is only the fact that she came there to specifically, well, at least my involvement was to be specifically introduced together with the CEO. And then we get there and we are not part of that meeting. And so the first question is, what is it that is being discussed that I should not be hearing? Or, you know, so that is why. And if Freire came up and it would then have amounted to an investigative meeting, we should have entitled me to be there.
My third question is the following. You stated in the course of your oral evidence before the committee that at some point you felt that Advocate Makhubane had aligned herself, the Premier and the MEC, the former MEC, and she appeared to be wanting to protect them. Are there any other politicians that you, other than these two, that you felt she was aligning herself to and was wanting to protect them?
From the point of view that me sitting in the Free State, I investigated or interacted with politicians. No, that was the only matter. So it was only confined to those two politicians. Elsewhere, you know, I didn't really have jurisdiction. I don't know whether there were investigations that she had meetings with the politicians involved. But with this specific one, she also had those meetings with them before issuing her 2018 February report. She also had meetings with both Mr. Makhashule and Mr. Zwane. I gather that from the email correspondence here, which says from the meeting we had yesterday with Premier Ace Makhashule, it then says to me there was a meeting which these officials who wrote this email when they are addressing to her that she had. So, yes, and I'm not involved in politics, but I do have politics. I do follow the politics of the country, the media does categorize people in terms of who they support or who they align themselves. And my view, certainly in relation to the freedom matter, led me to that belief.
Again, in the course of your oral evidence before the committee, you referred to the public protector as an aspirant prosecutor. You also stated that you called her or you referred to her as an aspirant prosecutor because you had previously worked with her. When did you work with her as a prosecutor? I just want more details as to why you refer to her as an aspirant prosecutor as opposed to an experienced or a seasoned prosecutor.
I worked with, when I joined the office in 2000, the office was in its infancy stages of being formed. Advocate Makhubane is one of the officials that came from the Department of Justice that was seconded to this office. And so when I came to the office, she was already there along with others. And we had interactions. And one of them, I know she's the one who told me, I can't remember in what context, but we'd all talk there. I remember some of us there were magistrates before, and would discuss. And I remember one of the ladies who was a prosecutor would say, for instance, she hates attorneys like us because we speak for criminals and get them free. And I would say, it's because you come from a prosecutorial background and you are trained only to prosecute and not. But certainly with Advocate Mkhwebane, that is, she relayed that to me. And so that is how I know that she was an aspirant prosecutor. I do not have any information of whether she was in fact a prosecutor or not, except for what I recall she having said.
Okay.
Last question.
Second last, please, Chair. Regarding the Nkanda judgment, do you believe that the judgment opened the floodgates in terms of the amount of litigation that was brought against the Office of the Public Protector, or in terms of the number of reports of the Office of the Public Protector that were taken on judicial review by implicated parties?
I will not deny the fact that start off by saying that door was always there. Perhaps that judgment widened the door, particularly because some of the people that have an interest in whether or not they are being investigated and adverse findings might affect their livelihoods are politicians. But prior to that, there were not many reviews, even though that door was open. There were not many reviews. And so the trend then came where politicians would want to challenge them, and in most cases successfully, because they now had an interest. When prior to that, they believed that our remedial action was recommendations, and so they could not, they could simply be ignored. And so there was no need to even apply for a review. Subsequent to the Nkanda judgment, they then, it was imperative for them to remove this cloud of a finding against them in order to advance their careers. Yes, it did widen that door, but it was always there.
My last question relates to I would like to call it the Limpopo assault or incident that you were charged, internally charged with many years later. When the incident first occurred, what was the reaction of the Office of the Public Protector? Had the issue of the assault been brought up by the office at any time before you were internally charged? I think it was in 2020.
I reported the incident firstly telephonically immediately after it occurred. And by instruction from the CEO, I had to go to the police station and report it. And then thereafter file a written report to head office, to the CEO, which I did. And so to the extent that the office knew of the incident on that day, yes, they knew from day one. And I've testified to the fact that both cases that I opened and the complainant opened were thrown out, and I did not see it fit to pursue that because that was not mine, and I was not going to be running to court wasting time when I had a job to do. So I really regarded it as a minor thing, and my feeling was that I did not assault this elderly man. I really did not. He's the one who I consider assaulted me, but I was not interested in pursuing that. And so it was only brought up, and I was charged for it after or as a result of me lodging this complaint, because even prior to me being charged, it came to the attention of the Public Protector, Advocate Mkhwebane, and the HR manager, and so on. So, 3 years prior to that, according to the evidence that was given at the arbitration, even then they didn't take any action. So it was only as a direct result of me lodging this initial affidavit.
Thank you. Honorable Hermans.
I beg your indulgence for a last question, please.
No, you did have your last question.
No, last, please.
Why? No?
Please, Chair, just the last question.
Okay.
Sorry, I forgot to ask you this. You mentioned that you do not have a security clearance. And you mentioned that under Advocate Madonsela's tenure, you were not required to have security clearance. It's only under Advocate Mkhwarane's tenure that you were required. And I want to get an idea of the level that you were required to have. You know that there's top secret, there's secret, and there's confidential. And if you are to go for top secret, that means that you must be a person who, you know, in your day-to-day duties, you handle classified information. So I want to find out the level of security clearance that you applied for, because you said you had applied twice for the security clearance, and I assume it's from the SSA. And I want to find out whether, you know, the level of security clearance, as well as whether in your day-to-day you would handle classified information, because my assumption is that you applied for top secret, if I'm correct.
Yes, no. Sorry, Chair. It is not only during Advocate Madonsela's term that we were not required to apply for clearance. With all the public protectors, it was never a requirement. It became a requirement only when Advocate Mkhwebane came in. And in all the years that I've been with the office, it has been sufficient to, we were made to sign confidentiality clauses, and which dictate that we do not, you know, disclose information about our investigations or operations and so on. And during and after our departure from the office, we were not allowed to do that. And so it had always been regarded as enough. I've never had, you know, that was imposed in relation as opposed to applying for security clearance. But when we did apply for them, yes, on the two occasions that I did, the first time I was in oh no! It started when I was in the Free State. Yes, the level that we were placed and we were required to apply for clearance was top secret, and so we lodged, you know, our forms with the security manager in the office.
Thank you, Mr. Samuel. Honorable Hermans.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and greetings to everyone on the platform and in the House. Mr. Samuel, referring to paragraph 3.1, you indicate that you believe that the present public protector had an orchestrated plan to destroy the office of the public protector. Please expand on why you believe it was orchestrated. What made you to believe that it was orchestrated and planned?
Thank you, Honourable Member. I did not catch the paragraph you're referring to, but I am familiar with what I said and testified to. So I will answer it exactly as I responded to it yesterday when I was being cross-examined. For me, the plan was that there was a purge of especially senior managers who had been with the office over decades. And these are senior managers that were involved in the core function of the office, as in investigations and reporting. And so the experience accumulated over the years meant that they had institutional memory. And in order to destroy an office, that is one of the targets that one would have. And for it to be orchestrated, it then meant fire these senior managers and replace them with people that would be loyal to you and do what you want instead of being loyal to the office and their work. That is what I meant when I said there was an orchestrated plan, because the managers, especially the executive managers that were appointed thereafter, including you know, other managers, they either did not qualify to be in those positions, if they did, they pursued what we perceived to be her agenda of destroying the office.
Thank you for your response. This is a very serious allegation. And would you say that this was done with other people or external forces? And if you believe that external forces were at play, which do you think those are?
No, Honourable Member, I cannot link that to external forces. Maybe external forces to the extent that they were either seconded or they came to the office either temporarily as either advisors or on some role, and these were some officials from the state security agents. I remember at some point one of them came in to come and become the acting CFO, if my memory serves me well. And most recently, one official who was released from SARS after facing serious charges in the disciplinary hearings was released by SARS, and subsequently was employed by the public protector as chief of staff. So I can't say that they came, except for those that were from the SSA. Yes, I can't remember, some acted in other roles as well.
Thank you, Mr. Samuel. My next reference is in paragraph 3.6. You indicate that the assault charges against you were resuscitated in 2017. I know a member has asked you about this before. Was this before or after the strategic session you highlighted in paragraph 93, where the public protector, as it would appear, implicitly issued threats or intimidation to you and other colleagues about the alleged misconduct?
I cannot recall whether it was before or after, but if I'm to take the fact that these comments were made as part of the opening remarks in a strategic session that we hold once annually, and during October or November, I would say, and my recollection is that these charges were reinstated by the Magistrates Court, were reinstated in October 2017. So if that is the case, it's possible that it could have been before or after. I cannot recall, but it was definitely in a strategic planning session, that much I remember.
Okay, so you won't say that it was there was a correlation in the timing, because you said it was before.
Certainly at the time, we believed that she had not received this information in the course of or at least she did not receive this information internally. But having been remembering that this was at the straight plan, I will accede to a suggestion that it might have been after she came to know about it, and that is informed by the fact that the office received summons in relation to the civil claim. I can't remember when it was, because the summons was not served on me. It was only served at the office. But prior to that, I was served with the letter of demand. So I cannot really place it. I would need to refresh my memory there. So it is possible that she came to know about specifically my assault case prior to that strategic planning.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Samuel. Then with reference to paragraph 3.8, you expressly indicate that, I quote, she lacks intellectual and legal knowledge, which is a very serious allegation. Can you further expand? I know you've spoken to it before in your testimony, but can you further expand on why you believe this to be true?
It's paragraph 3.8, you said, all right.
Yes.
My recollection is that I made these allegations, and you know, after making particular allegations, I would give reasons why I'm making the allegation. So I just want to refer there. Oh yes, I based on the fact that her conduct during the think tank sessions of not providing leadership or making informed inputs, which would demonstrate that she knows the issues, was not forthcoming. I remember, you know, only one incident where she was really leading. And it is, I can't remember at what stage during the think tank, but we were discussing one matter that involved a foreign national applying for either citizenship or permanent residency, and she was authoritative in her recollection of the requirements and so on in relation to the complaint, because she had been responsible for that at the Department of Home Affairs. But on other issues, I cannot recall her. I mean, it is based on the other issues or other reports that she demonstrated that lack of legal knowledge.
You don't think, Mr. Samuels, you know, normally as a leader, when you have a consultative process, which I think the think tank is, that you hold back as a leader so that you encourage others within the collective to share their views. You don't think it's a case of that happening. You think it's a case of ignorance on the matters at hand.
I battle to hear that question. Could you please repeat the question? I didn't hear it.
I think I just want your take on, sometimes a leader holds back when you have a collective, like a think tank. You hold back because you want others to share their ideas. You don't think that was a strategy. You think it was more because of ignorance on the matters.
Yes, it is possible. Anyone can do that. But, you know, I don't recall any situation subsequent to that kind of conduct where she would, you know, she would come with her own direction, which demonstrates that she has perhaps looked at or thought about what her views should be on a particular matter. But it is possible. I'll concede.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Samuel. You also indicated about the soaring legal costs that directly impacted the outreach clinics of the office of the PP would conduct in communities. Did this have a negative impact on the number of complaints that the office received from the public? So did the numbers decline, the numbers of complaints?
No, my recollection is that they did not decline. But the numbers did. I cannot recall that they declined, but to the extent that we were not holding outreach clinics or conducting outreach clinics, which was one source of complaints coming into the office, or at least giving advice, that did not happen. So maybe as a direct consequence of the shift being made from outreach clinics, the direct consequence would be that we were not going out to get complaints. But, you know, complaints were still coming in from direct visits to the offices or people lodging them over the phone, those that could afford. So I cannot authoritatively say that they declined. But okay. Certainly the trust in the office began to decline.
Thank you. Chairperson, can I request you that when the witness is on the floor, that we don't have people going in and out of the door behind him? It is very distracting. Just my last question.
It is your last question. Yes, thank you. And I've taken note of the issue you've raised.
Yes. No, it's just related to the previous question. Do you think that it was malicious, that the public protector acted maliciously, when the number of outreach clinics were reduced because of lack of budget? Do you think it was malicious?
I would say yes. I would reluctantly say yes, you know, because the outreach clinics were, you know, are part of our outreach program, which is the only means that we are able to access, or one of the means we are able to access communities as required by the Constitution. So changing that for me is effectively limiting or closing the door to those members of the communities that we cannot, or that cannot reach our office by any other means. So malicious is really a strong word, but you know, to the extent that it was self-serving, I would rather replace it with that word. Yes, I think it was self-serving, but malice, I cannot really. I withdraw my earlier suggestion that it could be. No, I think it's too strong a word.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Hermans. I recognize Honorable Mangetsi Tlape.
Thank you, Chair. And good morning to Dr. Samuels. Dr. Samuel, morning, I just want to go back to your main evidence, the issue of the meeting with the Premier. You indicated in your evidence, in Chief, that the PP at first did not want to meet the Premier. But after receiving a phone call in your presence, she immediately changed her mind. Did you inquire from her on the day what or who made her change her mind? And if not, why not?
No, I did not inquire from her. And as to why not, I did not think it necessary to question her. Just like when she said she would not meet with him, I did not ask why. And so subsequent to that, when she changed her mind, I could not even ask her. I think it was her prerogative to decide who to meet and who not to meet. So I had no issue being involved in that. I had relayed the message, so for me that was sufficient.
Okay. And now, the previous witness indicated that for meetings as such, there were preparations that were done beforehand. Just want to find out from you, did you prepare discussions that you were going to hold with the Premier in the meeting that was scheduled? Do you have anything that you wrote as to what should be discussed? Like it was indicated by the previous witness that they will always prepare some notes as to what has to be discussed. If you didn't, why didn't you do that? Or if you have, are we able to know what is it that you prepared for that meeting?
To my understanding, the previous witness, you might be referring to Mr. Kekana. And my recollection is that he specified the kind of meetings that where that preparation would be necessary. And those would be investigative meetings with the politicians. My understanding of the meeting she had with Mr. Magashule was that she was going to, apart from whatever she was going to be talking to him about, was going to introduce me and the CEO. And as part of the stakeholder management, stakeholder visits, it was not an investigative meeting. So I did not prepare anything for the meeting because it was only about introduction. And my thinking was that after that introduction, and the Premier gets to know me, at least he has been introduced, he would perhaps warm up to cooperating with my advances in relation to investigations. But that specific meeting, I did not regard it as an investigative meeting, so there was no preparation for it.
Thanks, Dr. Samuels. That takes me to paragraph 139.3 regarding the meeting schedule between the PP, yourself, and the CEO. You also indicate there that the PP had a private meeting with the Premier of the Free State. Talking about stakeholders, as you just alluded to, was it usual for the PP to privately meet with politicians while conducting investigations?
Not while conducting investigations, but as part of the stakeholder, which that was, it was usual. So there was no, we understood that we had to prepare a program for both events, as I've testified that it was the meeting with politicians and then with the outreach office, with the members of the public. Sometimes it would be that we'd meet the members of the public first and then the politicians, where we knew that the meeting with the public would generate issues that she might want to take up with the politicians. Those meetings would take place, besides the formal stakeholder address as in the legislature. She would be in the holding room with politicians, but we were always present in those meetings. I would be present as the host, hosting her in my province. I would invariably get the role, either myself or the spokesperson, to introduce her to the politicians or the leaders that were in the holding room. And it was not only confined to politicians, but even after meeting with the Premier at the time in his office, she did go into the holding room at the legislature, and she did have that meeting with them. And I was also not part of that. So as to whether it was usual, yes, it was usual, but not in relation to investigations.
Now, are you saying for this said meeting that it was between yourself, the PP, and CEO, that she had that meeting with the Premier of the Free State was a normal kind of thing? It was, there's nothing untoward, there's nothing unusual about it?
Ordinarily, there would be nothing untoward about it. My gripe is with the fact that I was specifically invited to be introduced, to be present in that meeting and to be introduced. I'm not saying that she was not entitled to do that. All I'm saying is that for the purpose that I was there and I was called for, it did not take place. She could easily have said, no, I've changed my mind. I'll go and meet with him and I'm going to go alone. I would still not question that because I would not believe that it is about an investigation, which would then entitle me, especially if it's an investigation that I'm involved in, which would then be normal for me to be there.
Thanks, Dr. Samuel. Thanks for the opportunity, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Tlape. I now recognize Honorable Zungula. Just before I go to you, Honorable Zungula, I see Honorable Peters, you had your hand up. You're still also on the list. Peters, Honorable Peters.
Yes, Chair. Should I speak now, Chair?
I have you on the list. I'm now recognizing Honorable Zungula. I thought there's something you wanted to raise before you speak.
No, Chair. Thank you.
Okay. You are on the list. Honorable Zungula.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Samuels, perhaps I could start by asking, do you have any evidence to support your claim or suspicion that the PP received information about your assault case from the State Security Agency?
No, I do not.
Okay. In your view, you state in point 9 of your affidavit that it is hearsay. It is based on hearsay. Is that correct? I can read it out for you if you are struggling.
No, I'm not struggling. Could you just repeat the reference you're making? Which paragraph it is? Okay. I do not get that.
Point 9. That your affidavit is largely based on hearsay.
Oh, you mean my supplementary affidavit?
Yeah.
In some parts, it is based on hearsay. And I do say in my affidavit that it is based on hearsay, which information I have no reason to doubt. And might be supplemented if the sources that I got it from, being colleagues, are going to come forward and be questions. They will then confirm that, you know, they are the ones who gave me some information, you know, particular information which I've testified about here. I'm making the point that even though it is hearsay, it is information that can and should be considered. And you know, the rules against hearsay evidence are not, in my view, applicable. But as far as the advice I received, are not applicable to this forum.
Okay. No, I understand you perfectly. Now, you have some matters before the courts, right?
I don't understand that question. Are you referring to me personally or?
Yeah, you personally.
Yes, I do. There are two matters that I have before the court.
Yeah. And you'd want perhaps the judgment there not to be based on just hearsay.
Not to be based on what? Justice? Or did you say justice?
Hearsay. Judgments.
Oh.
Just repeat your point, Honorable Zungula.
The outcome of those court processes, you would like those outcomes not be based on hearsay.
Yes, because those are formal proceedings in a court of law, which exclude hearsay evidence if it is not corroborated by any other means.
Okay. All right. No, let's move on. So in your view, what should happen to investigators who are charged with sexual harassment and breaching confidentiality?
In my view, they should, you know, there should be consequence management against them, no doubt. And I am strongly, as a manager, and even personally, I strongly believe that action should be taken against them. But at least they would then have to be given an opportunity to defend themselves and rebut any evidence at their disposal, if they have any, against those allegations.
Okay.
The mere fact that the allegations are made against them does not prove that they have done that. I've had a lot of complaints, for instance, from some female complainants in departments that would come forward and say, "I was forced to do, a certain thing because this particular official, who's my senior, made advances to me that I rejected." And invariably, my experience is that these allegations would happen behind closed doors and with no one else being, able to corroborate whether that happened or not. And even from the complainant, there would be no evidence upon which we can start investigating. And so it making allegations of sexual harassment against anyone are serious. And in most cases, they are made only for the fact that they will be there in the public against the person, and there will be no interest in pursuing them because there's no evidence to pursue them. I'm very afraid of those kind of allegations being made against me, and where I feel that my interaction with any person that I'm not in agreement with generally, when they speak to me in my office, I always leave the door open to make sure that at least people go past and see that not later on I cannot be, especially people that I'm taking any kind of disciplinary steps against, that they don't turn around and say that I'm doing that because they refused my advances. That is how I perceive them to be serious. The mere fact that they can be put to a person without proof can destroy them.
Thank you. No, we were in agreement that action must be taken. Now, in point 132, you state that Advocate Madonsela was not happy with the insufficient attention paid to the role of politicians. Now, was it practice that you follow the evidence or you follow people when doing your investigations?
I think it is a bit restrictive to say we follow evidence or not, but yes, we do follow evidence. And that evidence, will come in various forms during an investigation. Mm-hmm. Some of that evidence might point to something else that was not part of the complaint, or as we are allowed as an office, we can, out of our own volition, start an investigation if information comes to us that there has been some kind of action or conduct that we have jurisdiction to investigate. And so getting an instruction from, as you say, a person of the stature of the public protector, the executive head of the institution, would not be wrong, because in the course of his or her interaction with different people, she might have some information that we need to consider. And so giving an instruction about any particular action would not be odd or out of the ordinary.
So in this case, you followed people, not evidence?
There were allegations, especially, and interest that was in the media. And the point I'm making is that in the course of an investigation, you invariably get to acquire information that you should not exclude simply because of the source of where it comes from. If it is brought to your attention and later on you did not take that information into account, you might reach an unfair or incomplete conclusion.
However, I just want us to agree that in this particular case, the instruction, because as you are doing the investigation, when you find evidence, evidence can point you to people. However, in this case, it was not the evidence that pointed you to people. It is the instruction from Advocate Madonsela that you need to follow people. But let's move on. In point 134.4, you say, I can only speculate that the PP and the Premier discussed the Friday investigation. Now, would it be fair that the committee now must take that speculation from you as you are putting it? And maybe it must consider that indeed there was a discussion between the PP and the Premier on the Friday investigation, just because you are speculating. There's no evidence. You can't back it up with anything just by you speculating.
I'm going to ask you, with respect, Honorable Member, to please repeat, which paragraph were you referring to?
139.4. I can read it to you.
Wrong paragraph. Yes. The speculation came from me, and I'm not in any way, by stating that, suggesting for the committee to take my speculation and make it its own. My speculation is based on the conduct of the public protector in relation to this investigation and the fact that she met with the Premier and refused to authorize issuing subpoenas, which was part of the tools I required to complete the investigation. So I'm by no means suggesting that that is a fact. As I say, it is a speculation. How the committee treats it is up to the committee.
All right. By the fact that it's part of your affidavit to be considered, it means you do want the committee to consider. But let's move on. Point 59, you talk about the outreach clinics. I want to find out how many people were you able to reach through the outreach clinics, and how many people were you able to reach through the radio interviews? Now, do you not think that the radio interviews, number one, reach more people, and at the same time, there was a lot of cost reduction in cost in utilizing the radio interviews more than utilizing the outreach clinics?
Honorable member, I do not have the figures in front of me, and you know, of how many complaints we received flowing from the clinics and or flowing from the radio interviews. The point I'm making, and this is my evidence, that there may have been cost savings in cutting down or even cancelling those outreach clinics, but that went straight into the face of the constitutional imperative, the mandate that we should reach communities, and it had been working well up until that time. And so in terms of figures, yes, they did decline, and that is perhaps why even the targets were reduced. And as a direct consequence of those savings, that money was then channeled elsewhere into litigation. That is the point I'm making.
Litigation that is necessary.
We will differ on that one, Chair.
So you don't think it is necessary for the Office of the Public Protector to defend a report they've investigated, a report that they think from their perspective that they follow the law?
There is nothing stopping us, and it is in some cases may be necessary to do that. But the decision should be taken with due regard to all factors and what the outcome should be and the desired outcome you want to reach, and weighing your chances of reaching, you know, of you achieving that. And, you know, just taking a blanket approach to say we will litigate irrespective of whether, you know, without taking into account any, you know, any possibilities of losing or winning, for me, it is irresponsible. As you will know, I've also lodged, for instance, an appeal against the criminal outcome of the case, and I did that because I fancy my chances to be great that another court will come to different conclusion. I didn't do that simply because I felt aggrieved that if left hanging, however minor it is, it is nothing serious. It is serious because it has the effect of me being labeled and seen as a criminal, particularly when I believe that it was based on the wrong finding. So there is nothing wrong with that being done.
Okay, two questions on this point. Firstly, what if the council...
That will be your last two questions.
Okay. What if the council advises that there are good prospects of success? That is my first question. Then the second, okay, maybe answer that. Then I can ask the last question.
Yes, it is normal for anyone or any institution to ask counsel and to ask either a legal opinion or to, whether formally or informally. And lawyers will always differ about the chances of any particular case. We always joke that, you know, there's no lawyer that has one hand. You know, a lawyer will tell you that on the one hand, this is what the law says, but on the other. And for them, you know, in some cases, with all due respect to my colleagues, and I'm not in any way inferring that this was the case, but a lawyer, when the first thing they will see when you consult them about a case would be an opportunity to make money. And in some cases, yes, they'll genuinely give an honest opinion. But it is there. It does happen.
Okay. Then the last question. On point 197, you say you have a criminal conviction that is stated in your initial affidavit. Now, based on the lack of credible evidence from you and the fact that you are saying in many places that it's either hearsay or you are speculating, would it now be fair for the committee to take all of your contributions to this process in good faith, whereas you've got a criminal conviction?
Chair, I believe I have answered this question at length when I was being cross-examined. I'm not excluded from, you know, a door cannot be closed to me for giving evidence simply because I have been found guilty, which guilt I am challenging in an appeal. So my view, you know, is that I'm unfairly being labeled a criminal so that the value of my evidence should be diminished. And I don't have any, I deny that I'm a criminal. And the fact that I have been found guilty, and as I say, which I'm challenging, should not and does not exclude my role in giving evidence here.
Chair, I would like to state that I want to register, that I want to ask questions to the public protector. But Mr. Samuel, it is not me that is saying you are a criminal. It is your affidavit that you are saying you have a criminal conviction. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Zungula. Your intention is registered, as was Nodada's intention. I gondu. At this point, Honorable Zungula is taking us to lunch. We'll be back exactly at 2 and start with Peters, Mautwe, and the 3 others. We'll be able to finish those 5. Thank you. We adjourn for lunch. Honorable members, stopped. Get 2.
Yeah, I, the, 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 the,